You're tuned to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. It's 8:59 and a half, and coming right up is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Today, guests include Grace Chang, author of Disposable Domestics, about immigrant women workers in the global economy, and Stephen Solds, a Boston psychoanalyst who manages a website on Iraq's resistance and talks about distinguishing between resistance and democratic movements. At 10 o'clock, it's a food show with the KBOO Food Collective. Topics include the benefits of a vegetarian diet and a program to get immigrants and refugees into farming in the Northwest. And at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, an Iraqi feminist comments on the weekend's vote on the proposed constitution and an interview with author and social critic Barbara Ehrenreich.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 17th. You're listening to community-powered KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. It's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning, the Old Mole Collective of artists, scholars, and activists tunnel underground to root out the larger significance behind recent events and provide interviews, reviews, and views that we hope lead to greater understanding, reflection, and action. I'm your host today, Laurie Mercier. Engineering is Tammy Dean. First up, Bill Resnick will interview Stephen Solds, a Boston psychoanalyst who has written about the democratic left and resistance movements and manages a website on Iraq's resistance. Then, movie moles Fran Michel and Jan Hocken will review the film A History of Violence. Bill Resnick will return with a short piece on military recruitment in the high schools. And finally, I'll be speaking with Grace Chang, author of Disposable Domestics, Immigrant Women Workers in the Global Economy, about the structural features of global migration and the demonization and racialization of immigrant women workers in the United States. Here's Bill Resnick and Stephen Solds.
Thanks, Laurie. Stephen Solds, welcome to KBOO. Stephen Solds, a psychoanalyst, faculty member at the Institute for the Study of Violence of the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis, founder of Psychoanalysis for Peace and Justice, also an activist in his local Boston community, and he maintains the Iraq Occupation and Resistance Report webpage. Stephen Solds, you recently wrote that an enemy of my enemy is not my friend, that particularly U.S. progressives should not be saying they are in support of the Iraqi resistance, much less proclaim solidarity with it. And you also say a left should distance itself from Cuba. Tell us your thinking.
Well, my thinking is that the left, which I mean the radical left, should be defined by what we're for and not just what we're against. In that article, which was addressed to a left audience, and I'm assuming that the vast majority of us are against the occupation, the invasion and occupation of Iraq, and many things that the U.S. government does around the world. But that doesn't mean that we should uncritically endorse anyone who's an enemy of the U.S. You know, there was a faction which launched on support of Saddam Hussein as a great imperialist. To me, that's disgusting, to put it frankly.
A great anti-imperialist.
He was not a great anti-imperialist. Right. I may have misspoken a moment ago. You know, he was a brutal dictator who was no friend of his people, who happened to have a falling out with the Americans and got on their list of people to be gotten rid of. But an enemy of my enemy is not necessarily my friend, especially if the left stands for something. And what the for, in my view, is democracy, you know, what we real democracy, not the very limited kind of democracy that the United States has at present, but democracy that involves the vast majority of people helping run society, economic and social equality, and freedom above all.
Yeah, nor the Iraqi resistance is made up of many, many parts, but almost none of them, although some of them, it seems to me, are, in fact, do meet those minimal requirements. Even if we distance ourselves from the Iraqi resistance while calling for an end to the occupation, it seems to me there are some forces in Iraq that can be supported and should be supported.
And most of those forces are, while opposed to the occupation, are also opposed to the so-called insurgency, or whatever one wants to call it, namely unionists of various groups, women's organizations fighting desperate battles for women's rights. My fear is that these people are natural allies, and probably they're going to be in exile pretty soon, regardless of which faction wins there.
Mm-hmm. What good, then? It's likely they aren't going to, regardless of which of the, quote, resistance factions wins. You say that it's likely that they're going to be forced out or killed. What's then the benefit for us supporting a group that is, in fact, likely to be forced into exile?
Well, that's in the short run. You know, progress is slow and isn't linear, and it's never been. Those of us on the radical left have often been in a minority, and unfortunately, it looks like for the foreseeable future, those in Iraq are going to be as well. But we do, you know, the labor movement there has had some successes, like in Basra and the Oil Workers Union. I mean, I don't want to paint a totally bleak picture, but I am very afraid for people. And the women's groups are facing a very difficult situation with the rise of the Islamic groups of pro-government and anti-government forces that view them as an enemy.
Right. Stephen Solds, you also wrote that a U.S. left or the international left should distance itself from Cuba, that, in fact, Cuba should not be celebrated but dealt with quite differently. Why don't you make that argument?
Well, what I'm trying to say is that the left should stand for both for certain principles and should speak the truth. We don't do any favors to anyone by putting blinders on our eyes. Cuba is a form of dictatorship. There's a small group in power who make the basic decisions about society. A number of people who oppose that are imprisoned or in exile. This doesn't mean, as a certain hate mail I've gotten, that I'm a supporter of the Miami right-wing counter-revolutionaries. What I'm also saying in the article is that we have to be able to deal with a little complexity in the world. If we take this friend-enemy view, this also is my psychoanalytic background, we know that people are very prone to see the world in terms of enemies and friends. You know, our president refers to the evil ones and things like that. And the left has to look out for that kind of dichotomizing. It's led to a lot of trouble in the past, and it doesn't lay the basis for a new society that has to be able to deal with the complexity of the world. Cuba does some good things. The health care is amazing for the resources that are available there, the educational system. But that doesn't mean that it's democratic, that that it's a free society where people can speak out, especially if they oppose what the regime does, because freedom is, Rosa Luxemburg, the Marxist revolutionary, said freedom is freedom for those who are in the minority. and in Cuba, that's not the case.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me in Cuba, though, that a U.S. left also, to the extent we have power, and there's in fact a little bit more power, I think, than we think, can stand against U.S. imperialism and U.S. efforts to,
definitely,
to destroy Cuba and to destroy everything good about Cuba and to return the old...
And against the blockade.
...mafia and be against the blockade while still being in a kind of critical support of Cuba that's saying the Castro apparatus has to be dismantled. But in fact, the Cubans themselves, unlike, let's say, the Iraqi, quote, resistance and the groups of them who have, some of them who have really authoritarian ideologies and stand for authoritarian reconstruction of one kind or another, either Saddam, you know, Saddamite or Islamic fundamentalist. In Cuba, they claim to stand for a democracy. And in fact, in some ways, they are democratic. Some of the relatively, they have some institutions, at least, that look democratic at the local level, like the popular tribunals and many of which, though, just are really instruments of the Communist Party's domination right down to the grassroots.
Yeah, that's the problem. The problem is participatory institutions can have a fascist quality,
right,
if there's not freedom at a general level.
Right. On the other hand, it seems to me we can point that out, but also say, look, to not just to Cuba, but to the people that we really want to talk to, that is the great bulk of Americans. We stand for a different kind of society and a really democratic one. The Cubans say they do. We think that they ought to really open up in lots of ways, permit more opposition, and not just permit more opposition, have real institutions of popular participation.
Yeah.
While at the same time pointing out the U.S. has not the least bit of interest in democracy in Cuba.
And I agree totally with that.
And would subject the Cuban people to an even more brutal dictatorship if the U.S. was managed to get a hold of it.
That's likely, but I agree. And what I'm trying to say is, because of that, one doesn't have to blind oneself to what the Cuban regime currently is, and adopt, support it uncritically, and blind one's eyes, because you can't build a society of freedom on lies. We have to be able to take the complexity that there are some good things in Cuba, there's an undemocratic regime, and that the enemy of that, the Americans, is not our friend either.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Stephen Soles, who's a psychoanalyst, a founder of Psychoanalyst for Peace and Justice, and he also maintains the Iraq Occupation and Resistance Report webpage. It's actually very detailed and full of reports on the actual what's happening on the ground in Iraq. I really recommend it to people. Stephen Soles, we've been talking about why it's deadly for the left just to uncritically embrace every movement on earth that proclaims itself against U.S. imperialism. Sometimes you get in bed with the dogs and you wake up with the fleas. What could you? It seems to me that the basic contention for that argument is that it's necessary to build a national and international progressive movement based on real democratic inclinations and desires and yearnings and institutions. And if, in fact, we just stand for any, quote, resistance movement, we're undermining our basic appeal and the basic reason that we're active and committed and the things to which we're committed. Give us the argument from a sort of a organizing or, you know, a psychological, psychoanalytic point of view. How come it's so damaging to be just completely uncritical in that way?
Well, I think from several different angles. One is that it's very hard to rally people around a position that a lot of people can see through. And the a lot of decent people don't see, say, in the Iraqi resistance, something to emulate. So from a pragmatic angle, and in fact, you know, a lot of the people on the left who take the position of, you know, the left should support the Iraqi resistance say, but we should do it secretly, because obviously it'll undermine the anti-war movement if we talk about it in public, which I think is ridiculous. If you can't say it publicly, then why are you saying it? But one is a pragmatic one. One is what it does to us, that we close our eyes to inhumanity elsewhere. And we have a long history in the 20th century of the left doing that, and it hasn't worked out so well. There's been one after another of some supposed wonderful society. I know I came of political age in the 60s when, in the late 60s and early 70s, there were factions like the Weathermen that thought Albania or North Korea were, you know, the epitome of heaven on earth. It turned out to be perhaps the exact opposite of that. We've been going on long enough. We don't need to maintain that. It interferes with our ability to keep our eye on what the ideals are.
Mm-hmm.
The ideals are not just being against imperialism. The ideals are to create a better world. And the third argument is the psychological one, that in order to build a better world, we have to be able to deal with complexity and to not polarize into purely us versus them, the evil enemy versus the all good, or that will undermine the existence of a better world, that we somehow, and I'm not sure people are very good at this, so I think it's a very difficult task. The new world, a better society has to be able to do that, or will not be able to deal with internal conflicts.
Right.
Groups within will become demonized and extruded.
Yeah, and it seems to me, to the extent that we sort of celebrate Castro or even Chavez, we sort of give the impression, even to leadership of the left in the United States, that in fact that's the way to be a leader, is to sort of
right.
be the great man doing things for people. Well, and what you do then is, when the people think, well, maybe we should do it somewhat differently, you get authoritarian movements even on the left, and to destroy themselves and destroy the left in the United States by emulating these kinds of practices. Stephen Soles, one final thing. We only have a minute. What do you say to people who argue, well, look at what happened in Nicaragua. The Sandinistas had a democratic election. They decided not to, in fact, go the Castro route, and they were utterly destroyed. And they were destroyed because the U.S. Told the Nicaraguan people, if you vote against the Sandinistas and get rid of them, then we'll shower you with money and we'll stop killing you through the Contras. It seems to me real hard for a dependent third world country like Cuba. It seems to me they really do have tremendous security problems. And we have to respond to that. And, you know, that's the justification then for the sort of armed camp that's maintained there.
Well, I mean, I don't think socialism, to use the word, is going to start in a small third world country, or at least, you know, it's going to exist for very long in a hostile environment. I mean, you're right. If the world's against you, things are very difficult. One can rationalize, but if they've taken the other route, it's not clear that the world would be better there. You know, for one thing, Cuba's been able to pull it off by being an island with certain protections that's provided. And also the existence of the Soviet Union as a protector in the early days. So it's the route I'm talking about is not an easy one, and there's never guarantees of success in the world. But I don't see the alternative as leading anywhere.
Yeah, it's even worse. Stephen Sold, thanks a lot for talking to us. Keep up the good work.
And thank you so much for having me.
Right, so long.
This is Fran Michelle here with Jan Hocken to discuss A History of Violence, directed by David Cronenberg and currently playing in Portland theaters. The film opens with a slow shot of a couple of guys, evidently criminals, on the lam, checking out of a motel. This involves killing the folks who run the business and the small girl who might have been a witness. We cut immediately to another small girl screaming. She's had a nightmare about monsters, but her father, brother, and mother all pile into her bedroom to reassure her. This over-the-top contrast between the two sequences sets the tone for the film. Viggo Mortensen plays the devoted father of the small screamer, Tom Stahl, who runs a diner in an Indiana town apparently without franchises, chain stores, or big-box developments. When the criminals from the opening try to rob the diner, however, Tom goes into action, ruthlessly and gracefully killing both drifters and saving the employees and customers. The publicity that follows, presenting him as a hero, brings into the diner another group of scary men, this time mobsters from Philly who insist that they know Tom as Joey Cusack. Although Tom's skill as a killer raises questions about his identity and raises threats to his family, it seems to empower his teenage son Jack, who finally stands up to a couple of high school bullies and who seems to have inherited his father's ninja fighting skills. This comes in handy for another carefully choreographed scene of violent defense of self and family, in which the women are safely in the house and father and son defend their turf. Jen, what do we make of this film? What is it saying about male violence, the American dream, redemption and forgiveness, the history of violence in America, the history of American violence, male violence? I don't know. What have we here?
About 15 minutes into this film, after endless scenes of bucolic America and the most devoted family that's ever been documented in film since the 50s, endless, sweet, and touching scenes of family life with some cuts to random violence. I thought, this better be good to justify having paid my ticket into this theater. And I'm not sure it was. I mean, this is a film called A History of Violence. There is no history of violence in this film. There's no cultural, social history. There's no personal history that would explain in a way that would pay us back for what we, I think, what we sit through in this film, both in terms of sentimental portraits of America, and this violence just erupts out of nowhere. I mean, we know he was a mobster, but how and why he transformed himself, any context that would give this, the use of this endlessly recycled mobster stuff, any redemptive value is beyond me. I mean, it is a typical tale about redemption and people can remake themselves in America. And, of course, even mobsters want to be good. Well, some of them do, very few, but apparently.
But those are the ones who can be redeemed, after
yes,
all.
As he was.
As he is by the end, I think. I mean, I guess there's some ambiguity to how you read the ending, but it's pretty clear to me. Yeah, I think I think
he did get his meatloaf at the end.
Yeah.
You have to see the film to understand that line.
Yeah, I mean, the history that we get here is the history of cinema and of cinema violence. I mean, I think there are a lot of echoes here of Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt, where there's the question, you know, is he or isn't he? Is he a good guy, a bad guy? Is he evil? Is he not? There's echoes of Shane and all of those sort of, you know, the gunslinger who retired, hung up his guns and tried to, you know, live a simple bucolic life but got dragged back into violence. You know, I mean, this is all stuff that we've seen before, and I suppose that, you know, I mean, a lot of people have been praising this film, and I guess part of the praise has to do with the sense that he is consciously making these echoes, but it's not entirely clear what he does with those echoes. But he is certainly drawing on very familiar material, very familiar scenarios and setups for the violence as well as for the, you know, domestic, bucolic, lovely American dream heartland, wholesome stuff.
We could probably add some adjectives there to make the point. But yes, I think it's a question of what you require of a film or what makes a film interesting. I mean, there is a way you could read it as an expression of this ambivalence at this point in time in U.S. history with violence. And there's always been perhaps a history and way in which the most extreme forms of evil or violence set the context for other more subtle forms of oppression and violence that men carry out. So against these mobsters, any guy who slugged his wife would look good, or any guy who hit his girlfriend would look good. I mean, you have this sort of over-the-top violence that then other men kind of rise up against. So even the violence in this family was justified. In fact, the film seemed to be a public service announcement for the importance of no restrictions on access to guns. American Rifle Association, the National Rifle Association,
just in case.
Yeah, just in case. And she almost didn't find it. You know, the wife almost.
It's important to know where your gun is.
Yes, but there was this, I think, very much this question, and it isn't a new one, of men who become feminized. This is a guy who submitted to kind of a domestication, said, I want to be married, finally kind of been returned to his mobster past, as I like being married, and he has a very kind of feminine son, in a sense, a son who's teased for being feminine and pacifistic. And then there's a question of, well, can you go too far? Because then they have to use violence to defend against the broader violence. What's protected is the nuclear family and the small town setting. And, of course, it becomes kind of emblematic of the soul of America and sort of a past innocence. But I'm not sure recycling all that material, I mean, I think it has to do more with it than this film.
Yeah, I mean, it's very schematic. It's quite clear that, you know, it's the men who are violent and the women. It's very striking that in that one particular scene of violence, the wife and daughter are inside. They're behind the window. They're looking out on this scene of violence where the father and son end up sort of taking on these bad guys. And all of the violence by the protagonists, the male protagonists, is morally justified. This is violence in self-defense. This is violence in defense of family, in defense of, you know, of my people, the employees and customers in the diner. So that, I mean, the scenes of violence are the most visually exhilarating in the film. They've, you know, got the fastest cutting and the most movement, and they're really kinetic. And, you know, after the long, slow takes of, you know, wholesome heartland Americana, you know, you're sort of relieved to have people shooting each other because there's something going on the screen. And, you know, I mean, you might say some critics have suggested that there's a commentary on that process that the film puts the audience through, because we do sort of hold with the camera on the corpses who've had their heads blown off and things like that. I mean, we get sort of moments of goriness. But again, I don't think that it really undermines the sense that, you know, we're really glad when the son beats up the bully and, you know, throws these guys against the lockers and breaks their noses and puts them in the hospital. And as the son says at one point, when his father is sort of chastising him for getting into this fight and getting suspended from school, he says, well, it's, you know, of the bullies, it's probably the best thing that ever happened to them. And you're put in the position of agreeing, like, you know, maybe it'll teach them a lesson. So it really is a rationalization and justification of violence. And, you know, I mean, even the idea that, you know, yes, there's violence in everyone. There's violence under the surface of this apparently bucolic, you know, domestic scene is itself not an unfamiliar idea. I mean, we've seen it in American Beauty. We've seen it in Blue Velvet. It's, you know, it's not new to American cinema either. You know, the I think the only one who isn't subjected to that is probably the little blonde daughter, who is the emblem of angelic wholesomeness and sweetness and light. But the wife, who is, she's a lawyer, we're told, and so she's, you know, like the representative of the law, and she takes out a restraining order on these guys, and then, of course, they show up with shotguns, so the restraining order is useless, and you have to resort to violence. But she, too, is, there's a disturbing scene when she's sort of defends her husband against the sheriff and pretends that she thinks he's who he says he is, but then in private sort of rejects him. And there's this disturbing scene where he essentially starts to rape her, and then she gets into it. And so it turns out not to be rape because she's excited by the violence herself.
I think that scene also was the only scene that broke from a kind of stereotypical pure good versus pitted against pure evil, because there was something in her that was also seemed to be responding to or accepting the beginning to accept that side of him. And so the ambiguity of her own relationship to violence was raised but not dealt with. I thought, well, this is kind of a disturbing scene, but what are they going to do with this in terms of how she is responding to or relating to this man she loves who has a violent past? But then it becomes just, does she accept or reject? And we don't learn anything further about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess one could say, I mean, the film does open up that, you know, that notion that, like, even the wimpy teenage guy who doesn't want to get into fights, he's, you know, he can, you know, he's got the capacity to beat the shit out of, excuse me, beat the beep out of somebody. This is radio. You know, and even the virtuous lawyer wife in the small town is, you know, is kind of turned on by violence. So, I mean, there is the sense that it's not this, you know, it's supposedly not this simple, you know, here's the virtuous good family, here's the evil, nasty mobsters from the city. And yet, you know, aside from those couple of exceptions, I mean, mostly the film really does allow you to separate, you know, Thomas Dahl and Joey Cusack. We don't know, you know, what it was that, you know, that led to this mobster deciding that, after all, I mean, he says at one point that, when she asks him, you know, did you kill people because you liked it? Did you do it for the money? And he says, well, both. You know, and certainly he's, you know, he appears to have been very good at his job of killing people.
And once you have a skill, you never know when you're going to rely on it. And he,
it's like riding a bicycle.
That's right. Once you learn, it's always there, part of your repertoire. But there was this split, as you were saying, between these two personas, and the split was reproduced in the film itself, this complete split that's also in the culture, between a kind of the good patriarch and the evil, oppressive one. And it doesn't work with the two sides of that split.
Yeah. Although it does certainly, you know, raise that question, which is an important one in American culture, and I guess, you know, it speaks to that ambivalence in American culture.
Although I think it's sort of there is the everyday good enough manhood, the one you want to have at dinner and for a nice evening out and occasional frolic in the hay, as they do in the film. And this is the nice husband, the gentle husband who gets up in the middle of the night with the kids. And then you want to rely on that violent manhood in moments of crisis, because the nice guy reverts to the violent killer during times of crisis. And in some ways that does register this ambivalence in America around a kind of gentle fatherhood that's kind of extolled. But then, well, during periods of crisis, you have to have the boot there at the door, and a kind of violent history that gets reawakened and celebrated again to defend.
Yeah, so violence becomes the fallback position, the thing that the baseline for what we rely on, you know, the primitive ground of what we can,
only way you can defend yourself in a crisis.
The only way to defend yourself in a crisis. And I think that's not a particularly progressive message.
That's right, yeah.
So it raises some important questions, but is less than satisfying in how it finally deals with them. Again, History of Violence, it's directed by David Cronenberg. It was based on a graphic novel, a comic book, essentially, which may explain some of the schematic sort of simplicity of the plot and the themes and the way that they're dealt with. It's a well-made film. It's, you know, it's skillfully done, good production values, decent acting except for that blonde girl.
But basically empty.
But basically not really moving us forward in thinking about American culture or American violence. This has been Fran Michel with Jan Hocken for The Old Mole, talking about A History of Violence still playing in Portland.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick here again for The Old Mole, talking to Megan Heiss. Megan, welcome to KABU.
Thank you, Bill.
Megan, you're with Portland Anti-Military, the Portland Anti-Military Recruitment Coalition. You're having a big meeting. You're soon to build the organization and to really go into the schools and talk about the military and the war. Tell us about the Anti-Military Recruitment Coalition and what you're going to be doing.
Okay. Well, the first meeting of our coalition was August 20th, and we got together. There was about 50 folks there, and it was a day of skill building, and we broke into teams, and we adopted schools to focus on. And the focus at that point was educating parents and students during the month of September about their right to opt out of their school system releasing their private information to the Pentagon and therefore to recruiters. And that was our big push in September. We were amazingly successful. We were at parent-teacher conferences. We were there before and after school, and we were meeting more parents and more students who were interested in doing the work.
Mm-hmm. Can you also get into the schools and like the Army recruiters do, and talk to people about the Iraqi war and U.S., you know, global war making?
That's a very good question. You know, one of the groups that's been really effective at getting to talk to classrooms of students are groups like Veterans for Peace, who have actually been doing this for years and have been trying to present a different story to students so that they have all the information to make decisions for themselves. And that's a good segue into our next meeting. I think classroom visits and education directly to students about not just what recruiters are doing, but the larger picture of the military machine, I think that's really important. It's one of the things we're going to be talking about on Saturday.
Our students and the teacher, both the teachers have to agree, I guess, to have you in a class. And then there's, of course, the students. Are they receptive? Are both teachers and students receptive?
We have found that with the support of teachers inviting us there, that we do have a respectful classroom. And there's a lot of students who want to work on this issue. I think it's important to not be preachy to youth and to facilitate a discussion and really help them come to their own conclusions. So I think with the right attitude, that's not so much a problem.
Yeah, I mean, this seems to me, as they call it, a teaching moment, right?
Exactly.
I mean, 16, 17, 18-year-old people, men and women, it seems to me, are all facing, especially kids that don't have money to go to college, the lure. There's always that lure of the military.
Right.
And it seems to me it's a real important question for them. I suspect they really want to hear from you.
Right, and you brought up one of the biggest myths with recruiting about the GI Bill and about funding for college. It said that only 8% of recruits receive any funding at all.
Really?
Only 50%, and only 15% of recruits eventually get four-year degrees.
Yeah, it's a big sham and sell.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
Megan, we only have another 30 seconds or so.
All
so
right.
Tell me where you're meeting. I know you're building your group, and you're building groups
to every
high school and middle schools, I suppose.
Exactly. We're expanding.
So
we've got a lot of momentum. We have to take advantage of it. Let's build an army of none. The address for our next coalition meeting, which is this Saturday, October 22nd, is Augustana Lutheran Church, 2710 Northeast 14th. That's about Knott and 14th in Northeast, and that's at 10 a.m.
At 10 a.m. this coming Saturday.
Yes.
And you're also going to have training sessions, I suppose, for people who are going to go into school so that they get their wrap together.
Exactly. We're doing classroom visits. We're doing neighborhood canvases. We're doing forums. We've got so much going on, and there's people in Portland who are excited.
Yeah, it's a great thing to do. Megan Heiss, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thanks, Bill.
Right.
You're the best.
So long.
Bye-bye.
This is Laurie Mercier again, and on the line with me is Grace Chang, author of an important book by South End Press, Disposable Domestics, Immigrant Women Workers in the Global Economy. Grace Chang teaches in the Women's Studies program at UC Santa Barbara and has been an activist in numerous social justice groups, including the Movement Strategy Center in Oakland and anti-prison organizations. Welcome to KABU, Grace.
Thank you, Laurie. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. This weekend, you gave a talk at a conference on gender and the politics of movement at Washington State University in Vancouver, and you noted that while the media has focused on sex trafficking, the numbers of sex workers coerced to migrate are quite small compared to the trafficking of other women workers. Could you tell us more about this larger story of global trafficking?
Yes, as you said, that's correct. The numbers of women who are trafficked for domestic work initially or throughout their work terms happen to be closer to about 40%. And those who are trafficked for sex work, for entertainment, dancing, are closer to 17%, which is comparable to the number who are trafficked for manufacturing in, say, garment work or other factory work. So the great attention that's been placed on women who are supposedly sex trafficked is really misplaced, or if not misplaced, then grossly exaggerated. I think that a number of the organizations here in the United States who are working on immigrant rights, migrant rights, and anti-trafficking, or organizations who provide services and support to women who have been victims of trafficking, understand that that the picture looks much more like women and men who have been trafficked in to the United States for all forms of labor, including domestic work or agricultural work or manufacturing work. And it is this huge focus on sex trafficking that we need to look at, and why that focus is not only misplaced, but in my view is more of a smokescreen than anything else. It's meant to divert attention to that issue, which is sensationalized and in other ways distorted, to take attention away from the fact that there is trafficking for all kinds of labor going on in the United States, and that trafficking happens to be sponsored by the U.S. government in many ways.
And there's this common assumption in the United States that immigrants move by choice, that they're attracted to the wealth and freedom and
right.
jobs available in this country. But you argue that virtually all migration is coerced due
exactly.
to neoliberal structural policies.
Exactly. One of the most common things that I hear from people when I'm talking about this issue, including students and, you know, people out there in the field, is, well, aren't, you know, sure, granted, they're exploited here and, you know, they're not getting paid well and all of this, but aren't they better off than they are in their home countries, starving in their home countries? And then my response is, well, we have to ask, why are they starving in their home countries in the first place? And we need to look at the histories of U.S. military interventions and economic interventions. And the, I think the military interventions, people are a little bit more clear about, but the economic interventions are less well understood. And they have to do with neoliberal policies, free trade programs, structural adjustment policies that get imposed on third world countries so that many small farmers, local subsistence farmers, are displaced from their lands and by the huge agricultural, the multinational agricultural companies that come in and displace farmers so that they are no longer able to survive. And the first group that tends to suffer are women. Women not only lose their land tenure, very often they go from being landowners to, or you know, small landowning farmers to agricultural workers, or needing to migrate into the cities from their home villages to do manufacturing work, sometimes sex work, sometimes domestic work. And the typical pattern then is for them to migrate from those cities to other cities in first world countries, doing much of the same types of labor as they were doing in their cities in their home countries.
Excuse me, go ahead, Grace.
So what we see is essentially a pattern of displacement that has everything to do with U.S. and other first world economic interventions and military interventions. Such that people who were, in fact, surviving, you know, at least adequately surviving in their home countries, are no longer able to survive or no longer able to support their families in their home countries, and they need to migrate. And that, I think it's a stretch to say that is a choice, right? That looks to me very much like coercion.
And in addition to that coercion, within those home countries, there's also the coercion that occurs once in the United States, engaging in different kinds of labor. I'm speaking with Grace Chang, author of Disposable Domestics, Immigrant Women Workers in the Global Economy. In your book, Grace, you note that U.S. immigration policies have sought to rely on adult foreign labor, mm-hmm. removing the costs and responsibilities of providing for social reproduction. And consistent with this, as the United States has come to depend more on women's labor for domestic or caretaking work, it has deliberately demonized Latina immigrant workers in particular, and hacked away at public social services for poor women and children. How has this transition taken place in these new policies, immigrant policies, been implemented?
What we saw, I think the best example of the phenomenon that you're describing is for example, Proposition 187 that was introduced in California in 1994. And essentially the proposition was established to deny all forms of social services, basic social services and public assistance to those identified as undocumented immigrants. And when you looked at the campaign for Proposition 187, you saw who it was targeted at. We saw images of you know, women pregnant, huge with child, in clinics, crossing the border ostensibly. These images that were smattered all over the media, including Spanish TV, and the message was that, you know, look at these hyper fertile women coming in to have babies and bring in their huge broods of children to take over our country, our beautiful country, right, and soak up all the services, soak up all the medical care and the our, of course, world-renowned public education system and all of these benefits, particularly welfare. And the idea was, in my mind, to paint or somehow portray immigrant women, undocumented women, as being these huge drains on our social service system, these huge drains on our public coffers, to paint them as somehow burdens to the state, to our society, and in that way, actually, to justify their being excluded from all of these different social services and public assistance, that they should have been enabled some access to, particularly because they are doing all of the labor that is the backbone of our economy. They are doing all of the labor, as you mentioned, the domestic labor or the reproductive labor that allows for everyone to go to work, men and women, as well as manufacturing work, as well as agricultural work. So they are doing all of these different forms of labor that should enable them to have the same labor protections as well as some of the same benefits that all workers in our society should have. But I think that it is this type of legislation, which, of course, did pass, Proposition 187 passed, and then became formalized in our federal immigration policy, and our federal welfare policy, for that matter.
Right. The dismantling of the social welfare programs
exactly.
In the late 1990s.
Yeah.
Well, with this kind of dismantling of these public programs and social services and attacks on immigrant women, how have some of these most vulnerable women workers organized to resist employer domination and state resistance to providing basic services?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the good news, and that's the part that I'd love to talk about more, because I definitely don't want to paint the picture that all of these women are just lying down and taking it. I don't want to downplay the fact that there have been many people who have been, because of these so-called welfare reforms, or as some of us like to call it, welfare deforms, right? There are, in fact, people who have been pushed into pushed further into poverty and into homelessness. And so I don't want to downplay that fact. On the other hand, many of the migrant women who have been working in these fields, in domestic work, in agricultural work, in manufacturing, and in sex work, have organized around the issues of migrant rights, and I think have done a better job of connecting some of the issues that we've been speaking about, looking at the economic interventions of the U.S. all over the world and the military interventions of the U.S. all over the world and how they have impacted their lives so that they've been forced to migrate. And then here in the United States, many of these different groups of workers have been connecting with each other and seeing the common struggles that they have. So, for example, there is a group on the East Coast of the United States, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida, who are primarily agricultural workers. And there was a conference last February in Los Angeles linking together these agricultural worker groups with other migrant worker groups, including sex workers, including domestic workers, and discussing the issues of trafficking and discussing how those the dimensions of trafficking are much the same for all these different groups of workers, no matter what industry they're in. We also have some really good developments, specifically looking at the rights of domestic workers on both coasts, many of the migrant workers tend to be concentrated, certainly not all. So we see, for example, on the East Coast, there's a group called the Domestic Workers United, who are a coalition of migrant workers and different organizations in the city of New York. And they've been working very hard for the last 2 years on a number of campaigns to try to remove the exclusions. As it stands now, both state and federal labor laws exclude domestic workers from the basic protections under labor standards. And these groups have been working very hard in New York and having some good success with pushing forward legislation that will remove those exclusions. So that's on the level of legislation. The other thing that they've done with a great deal of success is they have been working to institute a requirement for employment agencies, these agencies that tend to channel women into private households for domestic work and nanny jobs. They have worked to make sure that employment agencies are required to give information about whatever labor protections they might have to the prospective workers, so that if workers get into trouble with exploitative employers, they at least have some idea of what their rights are and who they might be able to turn to. On the West Coast, we see a really interesting collaboration among groups of both immigrant workers, including Mujeres Unidas y Activas, United Women, and Power, which is a welfare and workfare workers organization. And those groups, in dialogue with each other, have understood that they face many of the same struggles. They face many of the same conditions of being seen as welfare cheats or people who are sponging off the state, yet, in fact, they're doing some of the hardest labor in the city.
Well, Grace, it's good to hear about some of those more positive stories of and organizing successes of domestic and other immigrant workers organizing around the country. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm sorry that we have run out of time.
That's okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Grace Chang, author of Disposable Domestics, and this wraps up our Old Mole Variety Hour for today, Monday, October 17th. This has been Laurie Mercier, and Tammy Dean has been our engineer. Thanks, Tammy.